It's Friday, February 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, with peace talks suspended, Russia mentions a possible ceasefire in Syria.
He believes what he's saying. He's fighting for us.
The road to the White House winds through South Carolina and Nevada as voters scrutinize candidates. Also ahead, the cubic shape of farming. A century-old Albert Einstein theory is seen, and we remember a storytelling musician. It's all on today's International Edition. As the 17 members of the International Syria Study Group met in Munich Thursday to discuss ways to end the conflict and allow access for humanitarian aid, Russia says it is prepared to discuss the possibility of a ceasefire. Peace talks were suspended until February 25th by the UN Syria envoy last week. Russia on Thursday said its airstrikes aimed at the opposition to the government of President Bashar al-Assad over the past week have hit nearly 2,000 targets. A Russian-backed Syrian offensive around the northern city of Aleppo has, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, killed more than 500 people this month, while the International Committee of the Red Cross said that they have the results in a flood of some 50,000 refugees streaming to the Turkish border. U.S. officials are quoted as saying Moscow has proposed a ceasefire in place by March 1st. But U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner on Wednesday said Washington and the U.N. Security Council want it immediately.
There needs to be action in accordance with the U.N. Security Council Resolution 2254, which calls for a move towards full and immediate humanitarian access and a full ceasefire. So it's very clear what's in front of us. Again, there have been multiple conversations over the past week between Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov. They've been talking through some of these issues clearly. We've been expressing our concerns, frankly, about some of the actions in and around Aleppo and the continued siege of that town, which has only complicated the situation on the ground in Syria and complicated efforts overall to get the talks between the party, UN brokered talks between the opposition and the Syrian regime up and running again in Geneva. When the ISSG met last November, it was agreed that we needed a ceasefire put in place as soon as possible. And given the facts on the ground, the increase in fighting over the past several days and the alarming number of refugees headed towards the border with Turkey and displaced people internally, you know, it's just an added sense of urgency to get that ceasefire in place.
Foreign policy professor Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver told VOA's Victor Beatty the Russian proposal is designed to secure Syrian government objectives of defeating the opposition around Aleppo, and this is part of a pattern of Russian behavior.
The Russians are winning right now, and that is very powerful because that includes, you know, a long list going back to 2008 when there was they were in Abkhazia and southern Ossetia in Georgia, and then, of course, in 2014 with Crimea, and now in 2015 in Left Bank Ukraine, and now they're winning here. And so they want to really use that to the max for everything, to offset the declining economy, to give them back power as being one of the major powers in the world. So absolutely, and they feel 3 more weeks, they'll be on the outskirts of Aleppo, and also the outskirts of Lebanon, and they can claim victory.
Brett McGurk, a U.S. diplomat linked to the anti-Islamic State coalition effort, said Russian airstrikes are boosting the militant group because of the toll they're taking on U.S.-backed opposition fighters.
Absolutely. The Russians are, and this is not the first time, they're talking one way, but in reality going a different way. They're talking about how they're fighting ISIS, but that's under 10% of the time. Overwhelmingly, they're there to get rid of the secular rebels who pose such a threat to the Bashar Assad regime that they're sworn to uphold. And they've got one more Trump. Not only does Bashar Assad owe them everything for all of this when they were really going downhill, but in addition to that, there are rumors in Russia that one of the things they'll do at a peace conference is dump Bashar Assad and put some pro-Russian Syrians who are in his cabinet or intelligence services or the military into power and say, you see, now we have not only one, but we have a new government and the West has to recognize it because Bashar is gone. He's the one responsible for all those 250,000 civilians who were slaughtered.
In the meantime, on the battlefield in and around Aleppo, the French charity Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders, runs several hospitals, says they're being overwhelmed by severely wounded victims as a result of those Russian airstrikes.
They're telling the truth. And the truth is that the Russians don't care about civilian casualties. They care about winning, and they care about reversing that trend that goes back to 1991 with the disintegration of the Soviet Union and being once again a powerful force. And they're sending a message. And that message is being sent to Egypt. That's being sent to Jordan. It's being sent to the Saudis, which is, we are now conservative nationalists. If you want to stay in power in this dangerous world, you know there's only one country in the world you can turn to, and that is us.
Jonathan Edelman says Russian leaders, whom he describes as conservative nationalists, also know their constraints. They are prepared to slow or halt their strikes if the cost becomes too high in the terms of casualties, domestic politics, and international opinion. Meanwhile, Syria's information minister tells Reuters news agency that the fight for Aleppo will be tough but not long, and is confident of victory. He said government forces backed by Russian airstrikes and Iranian and Hezbollah fighters will turn their attention to retaking territory near Turkey and Jordan. One of the participants in Thursday's International Syria Support Group meeting in Munich was EU Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini, and she was quite active on social media as she tried to promote her agenda for the talks. Michael Lippin's right here in Studio 22 with us with more on that. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jim. Thank you. Well, Mogherini used a number of tweets to raise public awareness about those Munich talks today. Her office, which is called the EU External Action Service, or EEAS, tweeted a video clip of her speaking to reporters for several minutes before she entered a meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Now, using the handle @EU_EEAS, Mogherini's office also posted a quote from her alongside the video saying, "The future of Syrians is in our hands." And in the video, Mogherini says she will tell the Russian foreign minister that all parties in the Syrian conflict must facilitate a ceasefire and humanitarian access to besieged Syrian communities, and that those steps have to happen immediately on the basis of a recent UN Security Council resolution. Now, Mogherini, whose Twitter handle is @FedericaMog, also tweeted from her own account a photo of her looking at Lavrov from across a table during those talks, and with quite a stern expression on her face.
Wow. What kind of reaction did Mogherini get on Twitter for these posts?
Lots of comments, actually. A Twitter user named Stanislav also picked up on Mogherini's facial expression, writing this note under the photo of her looking at Lavrov: "Very complicated expression on your face. Hope the meeting went well." One Twitter user with the handle @Mudvik, who identifies as a pro-Russian person, had this message from Mogherini: "You should listen to him, as in Lavrov, closely. He is a very wise man." And then this tweet from user Ali Al-Mawali with the handle @Nawakis. "Ms. Mogherini, do not waste your time and do not put out your hand to a hand stained with blood." And that's a reference to Lavrov. Mm-hmm. And just before I hand back to you, I wanted to make a mention that we are actually streaming live on Facebook right now, and we hope you can follow our show there.
Well, we're happy to have everybody with us on the air and on Facebook. Be sure to follow Michael on Twitter @Michael_Lippin. I'm out there as well @VOA Stevenson. And, of course, our program page is @VOA_IE. Follow all of us. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The news never stops. So keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. After Tuesday's primary vote in New Hampshire, U.S. presidential candidates swiftly turn their eyes to the next primary election coming up later this month. That'll be in South Carolina. The so-called First in the South poll will help to further narrow down the field of candidates, which already is down to just two on the Democratic side, and the Republican camp shrank significantly after New Hampshire. South Carolina voters will cast ballots on two consecutive Saturdays, February 20th for the Republicans, and then on February 27th for the Democrats. Slotika Hoke reports.
The Iowa and New Hampshire polls produced different winners and losers for both parties. South Carolina is expected to identify the most likely eventual party candidate on each side. Having soundly beaten frontrunner Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, Democratic contender Bernie Sanders is seeking to solidify his victory. On Wednesday, he visited low-income communities in New York.
He believes what he's saying. He's fighting for us. And that's what I like about Bernie Sanders.
But Hillary Clinton enjoys strong support in South Carolina and is working to return to the top.
We've learned it's not whether you get knocked down that matters. It's whether you get back up.
Republican Ted Cruz was not able to repeat his surprise Iowa victory in the northeastern state, where billionaire Donald Trump firmly reestablished his lead position. And some analysts say he is likely to win in South Carolina.
He's probably going to do very well in South Carolina. And then the question for the rest of the Republican Party becomes, is there anyone who can stop him? Right now, Trump doesn't have the kind of support you expect a presidential nominee to have from elected officials and other party leaders.
But Trump gained a new rival in Ohio Governor John Kasich, who is enthusiastic after taking second place in New Hampshire and maybe more acceptable to party leaders.
I'm really looking forward to the South. I'm really looking forward to the Midwest. I can't wait to go to Michigan.
Poor showings in both Iowa and New Hampshire forced two more Republican candidates to drop out of the race, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former business executive Carly Fiorina. Marco Rubio, a U.S. senator from Florida, is not giving up following a boost he received from Iowa voters. Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush did not make progress in the two key polls, but has the support of powerful donors and a family that includes two former presidents. Slarica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
Well, I'm sure the candidates have a lot to keep up with, especially their time. You know, gravity waves was one of Albert Einstein's most interesting predictions about the weirdness of space-time. And it's been an elusive but accepted element of theory of general relativity. Now, it appears that a coalition of scientists from Caltech, MIT, and the LIGO Scientific Collaboration have finally found them. It only took them a century. Researchers Thursday likened this discovery to the difference between looking at a piece of music on paper and then hearing it in real life. Albert Einstein debuted his notions on gravitational waves almost exactly 100 years ago. Scientists have been looking for them ever since. Gravitational waves are pretty easy to imagine but hard to comprehend. If you think of what happens when you throw a rock in a pond, ripples spread out from the point where your rock hits the water. Now you can imagine space-time as the surface of the pond and something with a mass as the rock. Gravitational waves then would be the ripples. That sounds pretty easy, but what does it mean for us? Probably not much, but each time that a gravitational wave passes through Earth, our planet expands or contracts as the wave goes by. Einstein predicted that these expansions and contractions should be observable, and now they are, thanks to the billion-dollar laser interferometer gravitational wave observatory. Its only job was to find gravitational waves, and it's been looking for them off and on since 2002. In fact, 40 years ago, scientists had already done the math to prove that gravitational waves exist, but the waves had never been actually seen, that is, until now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
We'll be right back.
I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
We use our smartphones for a lot of different things, but you know, one day you may be using it to grow your vegetables. A Taipei-based company has developed a Farm Cube, a small enclosed ecosystem designed to grow plants indoors. The environment inside is automatically adjusted by the cube, but it can also be controlled, of course, through an app. VOA's Deborah Block tells International Edition host Susan Yockey more about this gardening system.
What this thing is, this Farm Cube, which has been developed by a Taipei-based company, is 1 meter by 2 meter, 85 centimeters tall, and it's an enclosed ecosystem designed to grow food indoors. Every 6 weeks, this cube can grow between 100 and 200 vegetables, depending on the size of the, you know, the seedlings and, of course, the vegetables themselves.
Well, how does it work?
Well, the cube is really interesting. It uses hydroponics, which is growing plants without soil, and this is where the nutrients are dissolved in water and fed directly to the roots. Seedlings are placed in the cube that uses sensors. This is automated farming software that controls the correct amount of air, water, fertilizer, and LED lights as the plants grow. Now, a fan directs the airflow. And interestingly, red light promotes the growth of the seedlings, while the white light supports the established plants. All the water is purified by ultraviolet light, so it's safe, and there's no need to wash the vegetables because it's self-contained and there's not going to be any pesky bugs in there. Now, I should mention, with an app, you can also monitor the growing process yourself or make adjustments to the air temperature, humidity, light settings, and even more.
Well, you could grow tomatoes, celery, lettuce, just about anything?
It looks like you can, right now anyway. This particular cube that I saw had lettuce in it, but I think that in the future, this contraption might get even larger, and we'll see, different types of small and large vegetables growing in it.
Sounds great. Well, how much does this thing cost? And that's bottom line. And how do I get one? I like the idea.
Well, I like the idea, too, but I can't afford it.
Oh.
It's quite expensive. You know, all new technology is usually pretty expensive.
Uh-huh.
It's actually $1,000 each.
Yeesh.
That's each cube. Now,
that's pretty pricey lettuce.
It's pretty pricey anything right now. But I would imagine over time that this might go down. I mean, I see the day where, you might go into your kitchen and have a wall where these cubes might be lined up and you just walk over there and get your lettuce and whatever else you're growing over there, your herbs and Your vegetable pantry. That's exactly
and
right.
And it would be wonderful for people in nations where they have food shortages because people could just grow it at home.
Yes. I mean, the fact that it's hydroponic, meaning it can grow in water, you don't have to worry about the soil, and also it's completely self-controlled, so you're not relying on the sun or the rain and the other things that we deal with when we're trying to grow our vegetables and fruit, no matter what country we're in.
Well, this is going to make Mother Nature kind of mad, though.
Well, it might, but I think it's going to make a lot of people happy in the long run,
right.
Unless there seems to be some sort of issues. I mean, we haven't talked about, are these seedlings going to just be from regular seeds? Are they going to be, genetically developed? I mean, that all remains to be seen.
Well, I interrupted you while you were speaking, so I'll let you finish my question, and that is, how do I get one?
For those people who can't afford it at this point, you can get it from the company Opcom Farm. That's OPCOM. The best way at this point would be to contact the company. You can look them up on the internet. They have offices in China, Japan, Germany, and the United States. And the company has started taking pre-orders, so it is on the market.
VOA's Debbie Block. American singer-songwriter Dan Hicks, known for his popular blend of folk, jazz, and country music, passed away Saturday in California after a 2-year battle with cancer. He was 74. International Edition's Steve Norman has this look back at Hicks' career.
by hook or crook. Yeah, I'm going to get it.
Man, we go back to it.
Just a matter of time.
Man, we go back to it.
Gonna lay it on the line.
Man, we go back to it.
It's like a baby with a shred on.
Man, we go back to it.
It's like a cowboy with a saddle on.
Man, we go back to it.
Hicks was known as the leader of the acoustic band Dan Hicks and His Hot Licks, which was a contemporary band of the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane in the late 1960s San Francisco psychedelic scene. He never achieved as much mainstream success as others from that era, but he was highly regarded by fellow musicians.
It's a baby with a shred on. It's a cowboy with a saddle on.
At his commercial peak, Dan Hicks recorded several successful albums for Blue Thumb Records, including Where's the Money, Striking It Rich, and Last Train to Hicksville. One of their big hits through that period was Shorty Falls in Love, featuring the Lickettes. That's right, the Lickettes, Marianne Price and Naomi Eisenberg, plus the rest of the Hot Licks, Sid Page on violin, Jaime Leopold on bass, John Gerton on guitar, and Dan Hicks vocals and guitar.
All the things you've done together since the gold day, making haste so as not to waste away.
Like the time we climbed the mountain just to see the moon, Fujiyama and the Rockies, we're going to learn it soon.
Then I would give my child in some amount of time, as the stars so far it wouldn't stop.
Hear what it is lying on the white sands of the beach in Waikiki.
Just to love you and me.
You've been listening to International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Zena Bobdell Rockman, I'm Jim Stevenson. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the international community in expressing zero tolerance for female genital mutilation, cutting. This practice, said President Barack Obama, harms and holds back entire communities. It has no place in any community and undermines efforts to empower women and girls. At least 200 million women and girls alive today have undergone female genital mutilation. The latest figures from UNICEF show that nearly 70 million more girls than previously thought have been subject to this barbaric practice. Female genital mutilation cutting includes all procedures that involve the partial or total removal of external female genitalia or injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. There is no excuse for such blatant human rights violations of women and girls. As President Obama said, just because this is a tradition in some places does not make it right. This practice is harmful and therefore wrong wherever it occurs. That's why the U.S. has funded programming to combat female genital mutilation and cutting in places like Guinea. At home, the United States has criminalized the transport of girls to undergo female genital mutilation, worked with religious leaders and community-based organizations to raise awareness, especially in some immigrant communities where the pressures to engage in this practice remain, and provided grant opportunities for domestic, non-governmental organizations implementing innovative prevention strategies. The United States stands with communities at home and around the globe working to prevent female genital mutilation and cutting. We call on girls and their families, teachers, health workers, community and religious leaders, and government officials to act together to make a difference, said President Obama. It's time to put an end to this harmful practice and to allow communities everywhere to meet their full potential by enabling women and girls to meet theirs.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.